You're listening to Trek FM.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Welcome everyone to Trek FM's local watering hole. I'm so excited to be here tonight. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I got a great guest with me tonight. Just visiting here in the 602. Mike Schindler is back. How's it going, Mike?
It's going okay. How are you?
You know what? Doing pretty well. It's it's been a long day, but I'm super excited to get to sit down and talk with you in the 602 Club. And before we get rolling on the episode where we're going to be talking about The Incredible Hulk, we're going to be kind of looking at a lot of Marvel films because we're going to get busy on a big Marvel film this year, Captain America Civil War, just a really hallmark film, I think it's going to become. And so we're going to try and get through some of the Marvel films that we haven't covered yet. Before we do that, I just wanted to remind everyone, the 602 Club is part of the Trek FM network, and you can find that network at itunes.com/trekfm, where we are a featured provider there for audio podcasting quality content. That's right. Check us out there. In fact, while you're there, hit us up with a star rating and review. We're actually doing a review contest for our 602 Star Wars feed. So check that out. Review us there, and you could win some amazing prizes. Just have that in by March 1st. You can also find the network on our own website at trek.fm. We're on Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And of course, we're at the listeners only discussion group, the Babel Conference on Facebook. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook. Or if you're at our website at Trek.fm, you can also hit discussion on the menu bar. Well, Mike, it's funny because I think The Incredible Hulk is often more likely the forgotten Hulk. You know, a lot of people forget this movie. And I think that that's because it came after Iron Man. A lot of people even forget that they came out the same summer. Iron Man was released first, and then in June, we had The Incredible Hulk came out, and it did okay. It didn't do as well at the box office, and it also didn't have the critical success that Iron Man did. It wasn't as universally praised as Iron Man was. Do you remember back then kind of what your first impression of, you know, this kind of the very beginnings of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, especially here with The Incredible Hulk?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was a weird thing because going back even before that was a thing, you know, there was obviously talk of a sequel to Ang Lee's Hulk, and The Incredible Hulk was coming out, and you know, they talked about how it was being recast with Edward Norton, and they had a new director with Louis Leterrier and everything. And people kept on saying, like, so are they remaking it? And the answer was like, no, they're not remaking it. They're like, oh, so it's a sequel? No, it's not a sequel. So it's another origin story? No, it's not another origin story. And it's like, well, what the hell is this thing? You know, what are you doing? Are you making a movie? Yeah, kind of. You know, I mean, it was very strange.
I mean, it's kind of a movie. It's kind of like a cross between like a movie and a play. I mean, yeah, come on, guys.
Right. It's like, what is it? But, you know, then you see it and you're like, oh, they're right. You know, they that was an accurate description. You know, it really to me feels like a sequel to a movie that doesn't exist, which is strange. But Because of that sort of like unknown quality, and also I think the perception that the first one was maybe not that great, the initial thinking, at least in my mind, in regards to this movie when I heard that it was going to be a movie or something like a movie, was, you know, okay, whatever. You know, I mean, of course I will go see this thing, but am I excited about it? Is it something which I'm going to have to rush out to on opening night or whatever? No, not really. And then Iron Man dropped, and there was that credit cookie, the credit cookie to end all credit cookies. And then there were the rumors that Robert Downey Jr. was going to show up in this movie. And now all of a sudden this became, you know, top tier blockbuster excitement, you know, and I couldn't wait to see it because everyone wanted to see, like, how is it going to fit together, you know, and all that stuff. So there's this sort of anticipation of it being, you know, the second step into a larger world, you know, and that is really exciting to me. But it is very interesting to kind of look at it as something which was probably not constructed necessarily with that in mind. And there was a lot of, you know, sort of speculation as to what this would be in relation to Iron Man and the other movies. And I think they didn't even know. And it's interesting to kind of look at it now from a different perspective, for sure.
It is really an interesting thing. Like you said, you know, this kind of felt like the next step into a larger world. And then what was interesting is I think very quickly it almost felt like people were had the feeling that this is kind of the first misstep into a larger world. Like, it, you know, Iron Man came out and I think it just kind of blew us all away. Nobody knew what to expect. And Jon Favreau just created something that was really magnetic and really special. And then this one came out, and I for me personally, my first impressions were, it was like, it's okay, it's a good summer movie, you know, but it didn't have the same impact on me that Iron Man did. You know, Iron Man is still, the original is still one of my favorite comic book films. You know, it's such a good, concise, well-told origin story of a hero that, for most people, if you're not a super comic book nerd, you didn't necessarily know. If you weren't a Marvel fanboy, you might not really know necessarily who Iron Man was, as much as, you know, on the street, people would know who Spider-Man was, or at that point in time, because the X-Men had become such a thing in culture, like Wolverine, those kind of things, you know. So, but it is interesting, as you talk about, the idea of looking backwards now, and looking at this film and how it all fits together with the rest of the cinematic universe. I do have to say, one of the things that stood out to me that I kind of liked is that there wasn't the weight of the Marvel Universe yet, and therefore this film and its subtle allusions are subtle allusions. And, you know, if you're a comic book person, you'll get them. If you're not, you won't get them, and it doesn't hurt you. That's one of the things that I think, watching it again, I was surprised at. You know, the fact that, you know, this movie's about them trying to create a new super soldier, because they're trying to recapture the magic of what happened, if you know your past, with Captain America. But it's very subtle, and if you don't know Cap and you don't know that story, you're not missing anything. But again, it was just kind of one of those things. But at that point in the storyline, you know, you just don't have all that weight. And I think that, to me, even rewatching it, it actually really helps the story. So,
I mean, I guess I see what you're saying. I guess the one thing that I would say about that is, while that is true, it has its own set of baggage, which is very similar to that, in that it is trying to build on something which they didn't really want to build on, you know? Like we were saying before, it's not a sequel to Ang Lee's Hulk, but at the same time, it doesn't have that origin story. And because of that, you know, in some ways, I feel like you almost have to watch that first movie if you're not a fan of Hulk in order to understand what's going on, even though the origin is different, just to get an idea of the character and the relationships between these people. Because we see this backstory play out over the opening credits, but it feels like we're missing something. It feels like we're coming in late. And while we're not bogged down with all of these characters and elements which we're unfamiliar with because they're, you know, external to the franchise, we're also bogged down with these characters who are very much a part of the franchise, who we basically don't know about. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. It's something that I had put on the outline is to their credit, because I thought it was really interesting. You know, Lee's Hulk hadn't come out that long ago from this, and it had not done very well, and it had not been critically acclaimed either, and just people didn't go see it. And I thought it was really interesting in the way that from the moment this movie starts, it's telling you the story, and that they use the credits to basically tell the origin story of where, you know, Bruce Banner and Betty Ross are working on this project that accidentally turns him into the Hulk. And I thought, wow, what a clever way. To me, it was a very clever way of being able to get past the origin story and tell that stuff very quickly and catch everybody up, especially if they hadn't seen Ang Lee's Hulk or they didn't have an idea about the comic books. But it gave you that, it almost gave you like that 2 or 3 page intro that you'd get in a comic about the origin story. Like, you know, if you open the original Superman comic, it talks about, you know, how he came from another world and it had been destroyed and his parents set him, you know, it's very quick and very fast. And that's exactly what they do. It feels very much like a comic where you flip through a couple pages and then you get this big expansive story very quickly. So I don't know, I guess rewatching it for me, it works really well. I don't know, like you're saying, if you haven't seen Ang Lee's Hulk, which I've never seen it, or you don't understand Hulk in general, you might be lost. I don't know. That's a great question.
So you've never seen Ang Lee's Hulk?
No, I didn't. It was for me a film that, because of its reception, I just didn't go see it in the theater, and I've never gone back to you know, actually see if it was, you know, worth anything. So
see, that's weird. I don't know if like history's perception of that movie is different or whatever, but I remember when that movie came out, one of the things which had me really excited about it was the fact that the critics loved it. And I mean, we have to keep in mind that this is in a pre-Dark Knight world, but I remember the reviews. I remember reading the reviews the morning that it came out and seeing people like, I'm going to say like Elvis Mitchell, I could be wrong about that, saying like, this is a thinking man's comic book movie. This is a movie which has a lot of stuff going on in it. This is something by, you know, an Oscar-nominated filmmaker, Oscar-winning filmmaker, and you can tell that this is, you know. And then when I watched it on opening day, which I think, honestly, is the only time I've seen it all the way through, I remember thinking like, this is not working, but there's some interesting stuff going on it, and I almost like had to talk myself into thinking that it was a good movie because I was like, I'm obviously missing something if all of these critics think it's so good.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because so the Incredible Hulk that we're talking about tonight has a 67% on Rotten Tomatoes. Hulk, Ang Lee's Hulk, has 61%. So it is interesting that they are pretty similar in where they fall critically about, you know, this is just a little bit better. They're both fresh on the Rotten Tomatoes scale, but they're really in the same ballpark as to what the general public seemed to think about them and what the critics thought about them. And I don't know. I want to ask you this. Do you think it's a problem with the character of Hulk? Because I was thinking about this, you know, one of the things about Hulk that's so interesting is that you really have a guy spending the whole movie trying to do the thing to which you want to see happen as the audience, but he doesn't. You know, you want to see the Hulk out and get angry, but he's spending the whole movie trying to not do that. And it's this weird thing about the character that you know, there's this real tug of war, you know, and to me, it's always so interesting because he's kind of trying to get rid of his powers, and we're all just waiting for him to turn into the big green guy, and, you know, Hulk smash.
It's really interesting. You know, I've always kind of had a problem with the character. I've never been a big fan. You know, back when I was reading comic books, working at a comic book store, I caught the tail end of Peter David's run on the comic, which is a legendary run that's considered, I think, still to be, you know, the best that Hulk's ever been is what Peter David did on it. He worked on the book for years and years and years. And because of that, I sort of missed like the glory years of the Hulk. You know, I was catching the end of it and it never like really grabbed me. And I always sort of had this impression of like, well, how do you make that interesting? Because he's basically, you know, kind of like essentially an animal, you know, in that he doesn't have like any sort of like higher form of reasoning or anything like that. And he's basically just punching things. And that seems really boring to me, you know, and it's a tough sell, you know, in terms of the character on the whole. Although I will say, and this is just, I think this is insane, but it's true. When that first trailer, I don't know, do you remember the first trailer for the Yang Li movie? Where it was just a little short teaser, I think it was attached to Spider-Man, where it was like Eric Bana like looking in a mirror, like in a bathroom.
Yes, I remember that.
And then he's like, does a whole narration, and then it zooms into his eye, and it turns green, and then it just says Hulk, and it says like coming like next year. You know, it was like a year in advance. Now I've shown a lot of movies to a lot of people, and especially when there's like a new trailer or a big blockbuster, I love standing in the back of the theater, sold out show, and watching people's reactions to trailers. Never in my life have I seen a reaction as strong as the reaction to that trailer. People were like, I mean, at that point, people were like, screw Spider-Man. And then when it says next year, everyone's like, oh, boo, you know? So there definitely is a fan base there. You know, I guess they were turned off by the movie, by the end result of that movie. And that's why Incredible Hulk came out 5 years later and everything. But I think it definitely is problematic. You know, I mean, I think that's why people respond to him so well in the Avengers, because it's not just him. You know, he works well as part of a team, in a sense, you know, and as part of an ensemble. And I mean, it is certainly interesting when you get into the fact that, you know, Bruce Banner is a genius. And when this side of him comes out, he becomes all sort of instinct and emotion, and, you know, loses all of his intelligence and everything like that. It's an interesting, you know, point and counterpoint or whatever. But does it work like dramatically? I mean, it seems like more of a philosophical thing. It's hard. I mean, I can see why they haven't made another Hulk movie since. I mean, I think there's also some financial reasons behind that, but it's freaking hard to tell a story like that. I don't know how Peter David did it for like 25 years or whatever it was, you know. It's tough. I don't know.
You touching on the idea. I mean, there is a really interesting philosophical discussion about, you know, how we control the beast within, you know, and the things that the passions that could overtake us and drive us. So that is a hugely interesting thing that does come from the idea of something like the Hulk. And, you know, it was just a question that I thought of while I was watching the film, because really the whole movie, you know, Edward Norton's Bruce Banner is running around trying to get rid of his powers. And the whole time, we're just waiting for the next action sequence when he's going to Hulk out and beat the crap out of things, you know, because it's you know, that's what we're here for. It's awesome. And so it's a strange, weird dichotomy that happens with this character more than any other character that you see, because, you know, you don't really have I don't feel like you have other characters out there that really have such a hard time being the quote unquote hero, you know, they're supposed to be. You know, like you said, Hulk doesn't turn into somebody who's smarter and whatever. He turns into somebody who is driven purely just by instinct. And that creates a very strange character to try and follow when he's in. And that's what I think it was interesting about this movie, is it does try to show that the Hulk is more than just that beast. If there is something else going on inside, and the movie does try to get to that point. So it's just an interesting question. What was interesting here, and it's weird going back now because I'm so used to it being Mark Ruffalo as the Hulk, you know, after both Avengers films. And how do you think this cast, at first Edward Norton, pulls off being Bruce Banner and really selling the role to you here in The Incredible Hulk?
I think that he's really good. I mean, I don't really remember Eric Bana too much in the role, but looking at him and Ruffalo, comparing them to each other, it's almost like they're different characters, you know, and I love Ruffalo's character, but I think that, honestly, Edward Norton's character works better for this story, you know, and his characterization. I think that Norton's obviously a fantastic actor, and I think that he really sort of had a good grasp on this script. I mean he should, because he did a substantial rewrite on it himself, so much so that the initial posters actually had his credit on there, and they pulled him and took his name off the movie because of the Writers Guild or whatever. But he did a huge rewrite on this movie, and I think that that's really impressive. Because it really shows that he has a good sense of what this character is about and everything. It wasn't just like a sort of a paycheck for him. You know, it was something that he understood on a fundamental level. And I think that comes through in the movie, for sure. There's like this determination that he has, which seems lacking in Ruffalo's character. And I know that the character is at like a different point in his life and everything like that, but there's this sort of like driving force in Norton's Hulk, which I think Norton is really good at that kind of thing. You see him do it in other movies, and I think that he's kind of perfect in this. Yeah,
I was really struck by, and what I really liked is the way that he is different from what we've seen, you know, recently with the portrayal of Bruce Banner and the Hulk. His the way that he's quiet and very low key is very different. You know, everything about the way he's playing the character, you know, he doesn't have any of the bumbling or the unsureness of himself. He's very confident. He just is laying low, especially for, you know, the beginning of this film. But he's never not a genius. He's never not confident. You know, he is just, he has this way of, I don't know how to describe it, but it's almost as if he's completely pulling himself back to try and make himself invisible. And he's playing that so well. I really, really like that. But at the same time, as he's trying to make himself invisible, I never felt like Mark Ruffalo kind of plays him, especially in the first Avengers movie, as almost more like the bumbling, I feel like the bumbling Clark Kent kind of figure, like he doesn't know what to do with his hands kind of thing. Norton doesn't feel like that ever in this film. You know, he always feels like the smartest guy in the room, even if he's also trying to be invisible. Mm-hmm. And that's a strange thing to be trying to pull off all at the same time. But I think you're right. For Norton, he has so much invested in this character that Bruce Banner and Ed Norton really kind of become one and the same in the film. And that's always kind of nice when you can feel that in a characterization.
Yeah, you know, as much as I love Ruffalo and love his performance in Avengers, I really would like to have seen Norton in that movie. I mean, not only for the continuity's sake, but also for what he brought to this movie, I think would have made for a much more different dynamic than what Ruffalo brought to the table. Like I can just kind of imagine like Norton and Downey going head to head, comparing that to the stuff with Ruffalo. And I think it would have made for a better movie. I think that Ruffalo was kind of more what Whedon had in mind when he sort of envisioned the character. And I think that probably played a lot into why they chose to go that route. But I would have liked to have seen Norton in Avengers for sure.
Well, and what's so great about this film, too, is that, you know, we are telling the Hulk story. And, you know, for Bruce, it is what's driving him, as you were talking about, is this love that he has for Betty. And that's what I really liked, is really this film is so much more a love story than any of the other Marvel films for the most part. I mean, even Captain America, which I think comes as the closest to that, you know, where there is that love story in the end. This is it's completely a love story from the beginning to end with those two characters. And he has this thing driving him because he wants to be with this woman. He wants to be rid of this Hulkness so that he can finally just live the life he would love to have with her, which is to be, you know, a scientist and, you know, to have a very small, quiet life where they probably have kids and just do their work scientifically. And I think that's really interesting to bring into this character. And it's the thing that helps make the Hulk transformation, and especially when they're together, so much more interesting than it is in the rest of the films where Hulk is in the Marvel adventures right now. Because, you know, and then they gave Hulk the whole the relationship a little bit with Natasha, but it's fine. I didn't have a huge problem with it, but this just feels so much more organic to me. And I think Norton is really playing that part very well.
Yeah, I agree. And, I think that it's unfortunate that they kind of just dropped the Betty storyline, because I think that it was a huge part of that character, and to just kind of like forget about it for the rest of the MCU is, I think, a big mistake.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, Betty is his Lois Lane. You know, Hulk and Betty kind of go together like Lois Lane and Clark Kent do. You know, they're just kind of peas in a pod in comics and for so much of it. And I was disappointed, too, that we never saw her again, especially since Liv Tyler is Betty Ross. And this is one of the last times I remember seeing Liv Tyler really in a film after the Lord of the Rings stuff, because she hasn't been in all that much in the last, 10 years. And I don't know, what did you think of her portrayal here? And, you know, especially since at this point in time, I mean, she was still kind of a hot commodity after coming off all the Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah, I thought she was really good. I mean, I've always loved Liv Tyler. I think that she's a really great actress. And I think the thing that she kind of does is ground the movie. She grounds, I think, whatever movie she's in, you know, whether it's this or Armageddon or Jersey Girl. You know, she has a tendency to really ground the movie and sort of present it from the audience's perspective in a lot of ways, you know, looking at these fantastic events through her eyes. I think that's something that she's really good at. And it is unfortunate that she hasn't been in more stuff lately. I know that she has kids now and stuff like that, and that's one of the reasons why she's not been doing as much acting, but I would like to see her selfishly in more stuff because she's really good.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. I completely agree. And what I love about her in this film is, you were saying, you know, she grounds the film. I was thinking, to myself, Liv Tyler has this incredible empathy as an actress. And I think that may be one of the things that grounds the film. Is that she has a way of portraying this empathy and this kindness and this ultimate humanity with whatever she's doing, whether it's playing an elf in Lord of the Rings or, here as a scientist, worried about this man that she loves who is turned into what everybody thinks is a monster. I thought that was really cool. And you know what made the... I made the connection that this story is Marvel's King Kong. You know what? It's so interesting because when we're there together, I mean, he is King Kong to her, Anne. And I think that just makes it so interesting, especially that scene in the film where, he has rampaged all over the college campus and he's taken her away with him. And, they're at the cave and, he's screaming at the lightning and everything. And he's trying to protect her. And she's just saying, it's okay. It's okay. She's calming him down. And it's exactly the same scene from King Kong. I just thought that was really, really funny.
Yeah, I mean, Stan Lee created the character, right? And I mean, he seems like someone who's really well-versed in pop culture and everything, as well as, great literature, going all the way back to Shakespeare or whatever, but all the way up to King Kong. And, I think that was certainly an influence on him. I think it would have to be when you're telling a story like this. And that's probably not a big stretch.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not from somebody like Stan. What did you, think about Tim Roth playing Emil, who will also be Abomination in the film?
He's so good. I mean, I think of all the actors in this movie, he's the best. And I think that his performance in here is the best. Tim Roth is, He's a legendary actor at this point in time. It's crazy to think, he's only been on the scene for, 25 years. But in that time, he's just, portrayed some of the most amazing roles in movie history. And seeing him here is him at his best, him in, this huge blockbuster thing. But that sort of, determination and evil, in a sense, is so... well portrayed. He's great in this movie. That I think is the thing that works best in this movie for me, is his character and his desire to sort of harness his love for the Hulk. Betty loves Bruce, but Tim Roth loves the Hulk, and I think that's pretty awesome. Really, I thought it was a really great character. And I totally bought him as, this military dude, who's going to do whatever it takes to get this power for himself. He's awesome.
What I think is so incredible about him is that he makes the role look effortless.
Yeah.
It's just so effortless for him to be that evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's really crazy, and what makes it so enjoyable to watch. You don't even have to think about it. You just automatically accept this guy and his motivations and everything because of what Tim Roth is giving you on screen. It really is, I think, pretty incredible. And so I'm really impressed by the work that he did in the film, and it's. It almost seems for him that it's not difficult, but that's what makes it so good. So yeah, I'm right there with you. He just plays the ultimate jerk, and narcissistic, power hungry madman really well. And so I'm not sure if that's a compliment, but there you go.
Yeah, no, he's really good. He's a really good actor.
Well, William Hurt plays Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross, Betty's father, in the film. And what did you end up thinking about what he brought to the role, especially as we look towards Captain America Civil War, where he's going to return.
Yeah, it's really interesting that he's returning. I mean, I think the character is fine. It's kind of one-dimensional, but that's just sort of who he is, I think, in a lot of ways. And, I mean, William Hurt's performance was fine. I've never been a huge fan of William Hurt. I know there are people who are, and, I mean, certainly he's great in things like Smoke and Dark City or whatever, but I've never, like, seen a William Hurt performance and been like, oh my God, this guy's an Oscar, you know, worthy actor or anything like that. But he's not bad. And I think, to be fair, in this movie, he doesn't really have that much to work with. I mean, it is sort of the one-dimensional villain role, I think. And it's really weird because, you know, we talk about Incredible Hulk being the second movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and how it tied in and how, I mean, I'm personally of the opinion, I don't know if this has been confirmed or not, but that they essentially retconned it into the Marvel Cinematic Universe in a sense. And I think that that kind of shines through with that last scene, which was shot, I don't think it was intended to be in the movie originally. I know that they used the crew for Iron Man and everything like that, and it was just sort of like a last minute thing that they threw on there. And I really get the feeling that they didn't really know what they were doing so much as knowing that they wanted to do something. And that scene really kind of flips things around in a sense. I mean, it looks like, it makes it look like the Avengers movie is going to be Tony Stark putting together a team to take down the Hulk, which is similar to the story, you know, the Ultimates, which heavily influenced the Avengers movie. But we leave him basically in a place where Tony Stark is like, hey, we're putting a team together. We need your help. So where are they going to pick it up now? Because I think that since that happened, the storyline, which they thought they were going towards, sort of made a course correction and went somewhere else. And maybe Thunderbolt Ross would be on the other side of things. And I honestly don't know where he fits into Civil War. I haven't like done a deep analysis of that trailer yet or anything like that. Cause I mean, part of it, I want to keep it fresh for the theater, but I really don't know how he's going to fit in. I mean, I can see him fitting in. I can see how they could use him to great effect in Civil War, but I honestly don't know how they're going to use him because there's a lot of different ways that they could.
Yes, I was watching that scene at the end and I was just like, this doesn't make any sense with the Marvel Universe that we know now. And it's very strange, and I don't understand exactly why they would be bringing him back for Civil War. And this is where my naivety of not knowing Marvel Comics as well as I know DC, to say I don't know if he played a part in Civil War, the comic book series, which he could have. And that's why they're using him, because they have him, you know, in this. But yeah, it's this weird thing because they, you know, he has been nowhere since then. So it just seems like if they thought that they might ever use him again, you would have just maybe put him in the background somewhere for something, just so you kind of had an idea he's kind of around, maybe a part of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something. I don't know. So it very interesting that, you know, and you're right too, you know, fortunately, William Hurt really didn't get a ton to do in this film that isn't very classic comic booky villain, the guy that just looking to create a super soldier, or it doesn't, you know, damn the costs, and not really thinking about any of the consequences of his actions. And so until it's too late almost. And, you know, that's very, very cliched.
Yeah, it's interesting because it is so like quintessential Thunderbolt Ross in a sense, where, I mean, it's just like this singular, you know, determination, this singular, you know, vision,
yes,
that he has, that I honestly think his character is going to be much more interesting in Civil War because he's going to be taken out of his comfort zone in a sense, or, you know, which is a trying to chase down Hulk in order to make more Hulks, you know, and, you know, being at odds with his daughter, you know, no Hulk, no daughter, just other things, you know, and seeing other aspects to this character and his views on the world. So I think that that could be really interesting. I mean, they could make him a hero in this thing. You never know. I mean, it doesn't look like they're doing that, but it's interesting. They could do any number of things with him, and I'm very curious to see what it is they do end up doing with him.
That's the thing that I was thinking, too. It'd be really interesting to have him play a role that you weren't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice to give us that twist, because at least in the trailer so far for Civil War, he just kind of looks to be playing the same character.
Yeah.
That he was playing here, but now he's more about following these rules, you know, like that's his new thing. So yeah, I don't know. It's gonna be interesting. And you know, on a whole, I think that's one of the strengths of the film, though, for the most part, as we talked about, you know, the four main cast members, all of them are good. You know, even William Hurt, he's good at what he's doing on screen, and all of them are selling their roles very, very well. And just the whole time, I really like, for the most, I actually really like the storyline that's happening. I like this storyline with Bruce Banner and Betty Ross trying to find a way to be together again because her dad screwed them over big time, because they had no idea that this was being used to try and create a new super soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really, really thought that was interesting, you know, because that's the idea of, you know, obviously science being twisted for evil purposes is something that's been happening for a very long time. And this kind of idea of this abomination of power and the desire for more power and science being twisted and used in new and unspeakable evil ways, I really, really liked, you know. And it was interesting to me to see and think about this idea of, like, okay, every time they've tried to create a super soldier that isn't Cap, it's gone horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and part of that, I wonder if part of that is not just because, one, the people involved, the guy who created that serum, why he created that serum, and the person they used it on, you know, because there's a innate, almost righteousness about Cap and Steve Rogers, and his goodness. And it's just really interesting watching all these ideas play out in this film. And I just really, really was resonating with where the storyline was taking us, with the ideas of power and science and misuse of power and all that stuff. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, I see what they're going for and everything, and you know, it's fine, and they get their point across well. I mean, I think you're walking a really fine line when you tell a story like this, because there is the sort of thing where it's like we need to be careful not to use science for evil purposes, or develop things which will be perverted into something terrible, you know, like, you know, which I think is, you know, maybe a lot of it is a sort of critique of the fact that, you know, a lot of scientific advancements come from military funding and things like that. And maybe what they're trying to say is, like, maybe we shouldn't be trying to create weapons so much as, you know, make things which do advance, you know, mankind, instead of trying to destroy it. And certainly there's something to be said for that. But on the flip side, stories like this, especially when you don't have a chance to really examine that subject fully, tend to turn into, like, we need to be careful as humans not to create things which will destroy us, you know? And it's like, yeah, that's totally true. But at the same time, you need to be careful not to scare people away from, you know, doing good scientific work and advancing us as a society, just because you're afraid that something bad might happen. You know, I mean, in the case of Bruce Banner, for example, it doesn't work with him. I think that he's just as righteous as Captain America in terms of, you know, his intentions are good. He's trying to come up with something, you know, which is, you know, a benefit to society and everything like that. Maybe it's not to fight the Nazis or whatever, but it's to advance the human race in terms of knowledge and everything like that. And it doesn't work. And maybe the reason why it doesn't work is because his Stanley Tucci is Thunderbolt Ross, you know? I don't know. Yeah. I see what they're going for, and I don't think that they do a bad job at it, but it's not this story in particular. It's stories like this in general where I'm just like, be careful what you're doing, guys, because people might take this the wrong way, you know? Or maybe you're taking it the wrong way, you know,
right,
in your telling of the story. I don't know.
Well, and that's an interesting thing, too, because you pointed out there, you know, it's not about not having the drive to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's driving the creativity.
Right.
You know, kind of what Tomorrowland did last year,
mm-hmm,
about talking about that idea of it's about what you feed, you know, and in here, obviously, what's being fed is this thirst for power,
yeah,
to have the ultimate soldiers, to have the ultimate weapons. And when you think about it, there's no major threat like the Nazis or anything else in that way at that time period, you know, when the movie comes out. It's not the same, you know. And so it really is this just thirst for more power, this kind of abomination of power. And so... but yeah, you're exactly right. And it is a fine line. And luckily, I think the movie does a pretty good job of walking that. You know, and what was really interesting is seeing that with the scientist who has been helping Bruce in undercover. And, you know, they go to his lab and he's all excited about what this can do, you know. But Bruce has realized that this power specifically really only has the power to destroy things, to like make things worse, not better, you know. So that also, that idea of, you know, science not having guidelines, you know, or responsibility in it. And that's another thing that I really loved in this film, is that Banner is the hero because has this willingness to take responsibility for his own actions. And even actions that really aren't his responsibility. You know, he's taken on the responsibility of the actions that Ross took and making them his own, you know, to go and stop Abomination and those kind of things. So I thought that was kind of a cool theme, you know, the ramification of your actions. They have consequences, and Bruce is willing to take those on no matter what it costs. And that's kind of that's what makes hero. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a theme running through most superhero movies and, you know, comic books and that kind of thing. And I guess that's done pretty well here too.
Well, and you know, it also, you know, kind of becomes the idea of just because one can do a thing doesn't necessarily mean one should do a thing. And having the wisdom to know the difference, you know, like we were just talking about. And that is a fine line, and...
I guess, here's my question in this specific instance is, like, because I honestly forget, but, like, what was... And part of it, I think, is because they basically explain it in the opening credits, right? Like, what was it that Bruce and Betty were trying to accomplish? Like, I know what Thunderbolt Ross was trying to accomplish, but I have a feeling that they weren't, you know, he didn't go to them and say, like, you know what, how about you guys do this and then we can use it to make a bunch of soldiers. I have a feeling that, you know, Bruce and Betty weren't on the same page as him in terms of that. What was the scientific thing that they were trying to accomplish? And I mean, I guess ultimately it doesn't matter, but assuming that it wasn't to create soldiers, then, I mean, you can say just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you should do a thing. But at the same time, I mean, if you think that what you're doing is going to be beneficial, then you can't really be scared away from doing it just because it might not be. You know what I mean?
Right. And their goal was to make humans immune to gamma radiation.
So that's pretty admirable.
Right. It's a great goal. You know, what they don't realize is it's just being twisted behind their backs.
Right. So that, to me, it's not so much the scientific thing. It's more the needing to know where the money's coming from, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
who's opening up that bottle of champagne?
Sponsoring your research.
Yeah.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah. So,
which is funny because that was just in Legends of Tomorrow that I was watching right before we were recording this. So, I do want to ask you about what you thought about the effects work here, and you know, because this is a really effects heavy movie. Especially, obviously, when you get to the end with the big battle between Hulk and Abomination. And how did you feel that worked? Because, obviously, very differently from Iron Man, which so much of that Jon Favreau tried to do as practical as possible. And then, of course, there's CGI. This movie, I mean, they just... You can't create a Hulk. You're not going to get Lou Ferrigno here in green paint. I mean, we get Lou Ferrigno in the film, which is great, which I loved. And you get a few other jokes about, like, purple, you know, stretchy pants and stuff like that. But, yeah, what did you end up thinking about the work that they do to kind of bring to life the Hulk himself and then his big nemesis?
I didn't really have much of a problem with it, to be honest. You know, it's rare that... You know, I'm going to be taken out of the movie by bad effects, in a sense. You know, usually I can forgive them. But, like, early on, I thought they did a really great job of sort of keeping things hidden. And I know part of that was just sort of, you know, getting the reveal of Hulk. But, I mean, I thought that the action sequences and the effects sequences were pretty well done. Up until they got to New York and the whole New York thing. I mean, I think part of it is the Abomination is kind of ridiculous looking, you know? So that you've got that strike against you in a sense where it's like, okay, that looks goofy. But then, you know, I don't know. If I had a problem with it, it wasn't so much that the effects were bad, it's that you can only punch so many things, you know? I mean, unless you're Rocky, I don't really care if you're punching stuff. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, yeah, so we know that this movie has to end with two big green guys beating the crap out of each other, and that gets real old real fast, you know? And at some point, it's just time to move on. So, yeah, I don't know. Not a really big problem with any of the effects themselves, though.
I didn't have... too much of a problem with that. I do think it may be the thing that makes people think of the movie in a lesser light is that Abomination fight. And yeah, the design of Abomination is okay. You know, it's always how you make the evil looking monster is always tough in any film. You know, I don't think that that's an easy thing to pull off, honestly.
Just to interject, the other thing about that is it's always like, and it seems to be a thing in Marvel movies in particular, like the evil version of the good guy, you know?
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
You're right. It's not very nuanced at all. And I will say, too, and this is a problem that runs through every single Marvel movie for the most part. I would say, there are very few memorable villains. And as cool as Tim Roth is in the film, he's not really memorable as the villain, you know, because he's just bad. You know, most of the Marvel villains are just bad because they're bad. And they're bad because they're bad because they're bad.
Well, I thought it was really interesting. I mean, to me, I don't remember Abomination at all, to be honest, but I do remember Tim Roth. And one of the things which I think is really interesting and one of the things which I really respond to early on, and one of the reasons why I think those early fight scenes work a lot better than the climax, is that it's a different type of bad guy compared to the good guy. It's sort of the opposite problem of what we're talking about. And while the Hulk is this big CGI character which just goes around destroying stuff, these guys are like elite tactical forces, you know, who are using like military strategy and weaponry and everything like that. And it's like this really strong contrast between this just, you know, hunk of meat which is punching and stomping, and these guys with their, you know, technology and their you know, military intelligence and whatnot, which are fighting, and that to me makes for a really interesting fight sequence, unlike just two big green guys, you know, beating each other to death. So maybe that's something that Marvel needs to learn, is that you shouldn't always just have the bad version of your good guy. You need to vary it up a little bit.
Well, and, you know, I think, too, it, just in general, a hero is only as good as its villain, mm-hmm. for the most part. Really, that's the case. And when I think of the most successful Marvel movies for me, the most successful one was, so far, Captain America Winter Soldier, and that is because the villain fighting Captain America is the very thing which he hates the most, which is a threat to liberty. And that is a you know, and it's encapsulated in Hydra, but it works so well, you know, because that's the ultimate villain for somebody like Captain America. And, you know, again, here it's like you said, it was actually that fight in the campus of the college, Culver College, is so much cooler than the one that we do get in New York. And I don't really dislike the one. I do think that the effects work doesn't hold up as well. Part of that is that, you know, the one thing I'll say about Mark Ruffalo over Edward Norton is his face is a lot easier to translate into Hulk.
Yeah.
Edward Norton has a very long, thin face, and that does not translate into Hulk face.
Mm-hmm.
And so, unfortunately, Hulk doesn't look much like Edward Norton at all. And that was, I think, the thing for me that, again, the effects work. It's like they didn't try hard enough to give you anything that really reminded you of Ed Norton,
yeah.
as Hulk. And that's the one thing they've been able to do in their more recent films with Hulk, is that you feel like it's Ruffalo's character. They look very similar somehow.
Yeah.
They just do a great job with that. So all in all, Mike, you know, again, coming back to this film and rewatching it, what would you end up rating The Incredible Hulk, do you think?
I'd probably give it 3 out of 4 stars. I'd say on the whole, it's one of the lesser movies of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I still do enjoy it quite a bit. I think it does kind of fall apart at the end, but on the whole, I think it is a good movie. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, for me, it was very strange to come back to this film, because when I was looking on my list, you know, we're both on Letterboxd, the website where you can keep track of all the movies you watch, because both of us just watch so many movies and we're trying to keep track. And I have my actual list there for Marvel films, and I was looking at it as I was watching this movie, and I was thinking, huh, it's really weird, because before I started rewatching the movie, this was actually, I think, third from the end on the list. And this has actually moved up a few spots now. And so of all the Marvel movies that have come out so far, it's actually number 8 for me. Which, to me, actually puts this at 3.5 out of 5 stars. This is a much better movie than I remember. And I'm so thankful that I actually am making myself go back and rewatch these for the 602 as we move towards Civil War, because I would actually watch this movie again. You know, I'd pick this one back up and watch it again because I really did enjoy it. I enjoyed the storyline. I enjoyed what Norton and Tyler are doing. And I kind of went really, I mean, it's a little cliched, but I liked the romance and everything that's going on with that. And like you said, I'm sad that we never follow up with Betty. And I don't think we ever will, unfortunately. But at least they did it here.
Cue sad Hulk music now.
There we go. Cue sad music. Well,
it's the sad Hulk music, the piano.
That's right. Hulk sad. Sad Hulk music play here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at my list on Letterboxd, and if you're not on Letterboxd, you should go to Letterboxd.
Oh, yeah,
because
totally should
it's
be.
Great.
Join Mike and I.
And I love, like, seeing what other people are watching, especially if you, you know, do, like, star ratings or whatever. Like, I love seeing what what Matthew is watching and being like, why did he watch that movie? And why did he give it 4 stars? That's so weird. You know, but especially like when you have like a movie where like, you know, everyone's seeing Deadpool this weekend, you know, I love to see what everyone thinks of this movie that we all just watched. And now it's like we almost communally are discussing it, even though we saw it across the country. But anyway, on my Letterboxd list of Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, I have it at number 10 in between Age of Ultron and Dark World. But I could see it moving up past Age of Ultron. I need to rewatch that movie. I could see it jumping ahead of the spot.
That's really interesting. On my list, it's between Age of Ultron and Guardians of the Galaxy, and it's right in the middle. But I think, you know, as I'm thinking about this, I would probably rewatch Hulk more than I would Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it.
So you have you have Guardians of the Galaxy at number 9 on your list?
Yeah. Guardians is, I'm a different man. I'm a different man.
That's one way of putting it.
Well, before we get into starting to talk about a whole different Marvel movie, we really appreciate you joining us here in the 602 Club. It's been a blast talking about The Incredible Hulk, and I really want to thank our Patreon supporters, our associate producers through Patreon, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson. I'm so thankful for these guys, and it's a huge year for us here on Trek FM. It's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. We're celebrating in a big way with the show that Mike had the genius to think of, From There to Here.
Genius or
help
insanity?
Us,
one of the
help us keep all of this content coming to you. You know, it is very expensive to put all this together. Editing shows, the software we need, the space we need, the storage of the files online so that you can download, the costs it costs us for you to download all those podcasts. We need your help. So go to patreon.com/trekfm and you can see how you can be part of the team. We do have some great perks for you, and we'd love for you to help make sure that what I think is the best quality content of podcasts out there on the net right now can keep coming to you. So again, just go to patreon.com/trekfm. And we really do appreciate your support. It means so much to us. Now, Mike, before we get out of here, make sure that you remind everybody of all the places that they can find you online and here on the network.
You can find me right here on Trek.fm on Commentary Trek Stars, where we look at the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. It's the other show on the network that's not talking about Star Trek. This week, we just looked at Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And next week,
good one.
Next week, we're looking at Rogue Nation as part of our JJ series. I'm sure we're also going to be discussing the Brian Fuller news at great length because it's very exciting stuff. And you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing Commentary Track Stars. We've been doing live recaps of all of the new X-Files episodes as they happen, so tune into that. And, yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.
Well, goodness, Mike, I'm so excited that you came on tonight to talk about Incredible Hulk. And, goodness, we really do, folks, have some Marvel coming to you We're going to talk Deadpool. We're going to talk some Iron Man 2, some Thor. We're going to talk some Captain America, Captain America Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War. I mean, it's going to be a great year if you enjoy Marvel films. And then plus, we're going to have Daredevil, the series, come out this year. We'll be talking about that. We're going to be talking about Agent Carter once that is finished and with its run this season. So, goodness, so much stuff coming for you guys, for you Marvel fans. Hey, if you like DC, we have that coming too, because there's a little film called Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice coming out, and an even littler one. It's an indie one. I think it's Suicide Squad? I don't know. Anyway, that's coming out too, so we'll talk about that for you guys. But you can find me at MattRushing02 on Twitter. You can also find me on Instagram and Rushing. You can find me doing The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine. Love doing that show with him. It's so much fun talking about my favorite Star Trek series. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We interview Star Trek book authors as well, so make sure you join us. It's so much fun, those interviews, and really getting behind the scenes of the brand new books in the Star Trek literary universe. And of course, you can find me on a brand new podcast with my friend John Mills called Aggressive Negotiations. You can find us on iTunes at Aggressive Negotiations, just type that in, or you can find us on our own website at aggressivenegotiations.squarespace.com. I do want to remind everyone again that we are running the review contest for the Star Wars feed of the 602 Club. Hit that up on iTunes. Give us a star rating and review. And we really do have some great prizes for you. I've got a brand new Star Wars mug for you. I've also got a Ractogino mug, as well as, I know this sounds strange, but a Spock shirt. And Norm is throwing in the Art of the Force Awakens book. So whether you're a Star Wars fan or a Star Trek fan, this prize pack is for you. So just make sure you do that before March 1st, and we'll be picking the winner. I gotta say, so glad to have you around the 602 Club, and y'all come back now, you hear?